Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for Banal of America
of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. Welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 9, coming at you with what I think is going to be a fascinating edition of the program as we welcome Fortean researcher Joshua Cutchin for a discussion on his new book, A Trojan Feast, The Food and Drink Offerings of Aliens, Fairies, and Sasquatch. And as I said at the end of the last program, this book came to me in the mail like a week ago, and I was just absolutely riveted by the whole idea of the book. I hadn't even sat down to read it yet, and immediately rushed to get a hold of Josh to get him on the show here and talk about this book, because it is really some fascinating stuff and some stuff that sort of lived on the fringes of the paranormal for a very long time. And now, thanks to his fine book, people can really dig into this enigma of food and drink exchanges between aliens, fairies, and Sasquatch and the humans they encounter. So welcome to the show, Joshua. I really love the book and cannot wait to discuss it with you here on the program.
I'm really quite glad to be here. I've been a big fan of yours for a while, and It means a lot, so thanks for having me on.
Oh, dude, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure, man. Like I said, as you may know from listening to the show, I enjoy talking to people who do good work, and as soon as I saw the book, I was like, this is some innovative, outside-the-box thinking to look at something that's completely, it's been out there for a long time, but no one seems to have really dug into it yet. So kudos to you, man, for doing the legwork and actually digging into it. Tell me a little bit about, as we like to start out with the bio, the background. Who is Joshua Cutchin? How did you get mixed up in all this Fortean stuff in the first place?
Well, first of all, kudos on the name pronunciation. You nailed it. Usually I get Cutchin, which is sort of embarrassing.
Really?
Yeah. I get Cutchin a lot.
I don't know how people can mess that up. Weird.
Yeah, I think I always thought it was pretty straightforward. But anyway, so thanks for that. I have, looking back on it, I've sort of had a varied lifestyle and the sort of things that I wound up doing. For years and years, I was on the classical musician path. I play tuba and got my performance degree from the University of Wisconsin, a North Carolina native. I was enjoying a lot of good success with that. I would have to say, and this might sound big-headed-ish, but I think that by merit of the fact that I'm not really involved in the classical tuba community anymore, I can say this. I would think that at my peak, I was probably one of about the top 25 collegiate tuba players in the country. But
wow, nice.
That sort of ended up being a little bit of a problem for me because I was doing so much playing, and I had started out doing so many advanced things that I was sort of running before I could walk. So I got to the University of Georgia to work on my performance master's and ended up having some chop problems, some pace problems. And they were the sort of thing where I really had to scale back how much I was playing. So I took stock of my life and tried to figure out what I wanted to do because I didn't really feel responsible to myself or to a future family to go ahead and keep on relying on music for my sole source of income. So I sort of parlayed that degree into a music literature degree, which I never really had a true interest in becoming a music historian or anything like that. This was just a way for me to complete that degree. Then started to pursue a second degree in journalism. Now, the ironic thing is, now that I stopped playing the classical tuba route, I end up making more money from playing tuba now doing jazz and rock stuff than I ever did doing the classical thing. As sort of a supplemental sideline of mine. But I pursued the journalism route with a master's in journalism from the University of Georgia, and for the past 3 years have been employed at my alma mater as a public affairs director for the School of Music. Nice. So that's a lot of non-14 stuff to bring
yeah,
me to where
yeah.
we are today. You know, growing up, I was always a monster kid. If there was a creature feature or a monster movie or anything involving aliens, I was all over it. My family was really open to me reading stuff about UFOs and Sasquatch and all sorts of strange things. A couple of years ago, I started listening to podcasts and I got really involved in it. And I'd always been aware of the food taboo, as it were, in a lot of this literature, specifically the fairy literature, which was that if you ate food in the fairy kingdom, or if a fairy gave you food, you would be trapped in fairyland
right.
for the rest of your days. And it was one of those things where I was just expecting someone to write a book on it, or I wasn't aware that there wasn't a book on it. Because if you look at the literature, there are tons of references to this. Jacques Vallée mentions it in Passport to Magonia, and a lot of the old fairy literature references it as well. But nobody did write a book on it. And then it was about November of 2013 when I was reading J. Robert Alley's Raincoast Sasquatch, which is a great book, highly recommend it. But I stumbled upon a tidbit in there that said that anyone who took food from Bigfoot in some First Nations lore was actually destined to be trapped with Bigfoot forever. And I said to myself, that's just one too many parallels for my sake. So I started doing some research and saying, look, there's really a lot of stuff here to mine, and I can't believe no one's talked about it. And this is, you know, I don't know if I'll ever be able to write something else, but I'm going to write this because there is a whole literature here. So
yeah,
I did a bunch of research last year and started writing in April and finished it up in September, August of 2014, and been refining it since then. Approached Patrick Weege at Anomalous Books, who's been a wonderful gentleman to work with, a great operation, and this thing's out.
Yeah. So people can get it right now, and they should. They can also find out more about it at anomalousbooks.com. So that's the hub where we're sending folks tonight. Let me think about where we want to even start on this. You kind of gave us sort of the setup for it. I guess what made you decide to sort of include it's sort of an interesting trio, let's say. You get the fairies, the aliens, and the Sasquatch. They're all kind of different camps, if you will. What sort of made you, obviously the food is the overarching thread that connects all this, but it's like part of me, having read the book, was like, I don't know if I would have kept Sasquatch in there afterwards now that I look at it all, because it's like Sasquatch seemed like he was way off to the side of the food exchange phenomenon, let's say. But what made you sort of decide to go this route with the trio of different phenomena?
Well, you know, I've long been interested in the interconnectedness of the different phenomena, all the way back to all those connections between alien lore and fairy folklore.
Hmm.
You know, if I hadn't gotten that little tidbit about Sasquatch and taking food from Sasquatch and being trapped with the Sasquatch, I might well have left it off to the side.
Hmm.
But I felt like that was a significant enough connection to include it. And I just sort of let the analysis of these three different camps sort of speak for itself and come to a really organic and natural place where at the end I do sort of say, well, there are some similarities there, but Sasquatch is kind of a little bit more off to the side. But I've always been interested in not really a theory of everything, but I've always been interested in these little connections between these different phenomena. Because, I'm not discounting the fact that aliens could be extraterrestrials, or that Sasquatch could be a flesh and blood creature, or that any of these phenomena could be purely psychological. I just am constantly fascinated by the little connections that thread their way between these three apparently disparate subjects. So it's been a really interesting and and enlightening experience looking at a lot of this. I did my best to approach this from a completely objective standpoint, to let the data sort of nudge me in the direction that I should go. So
Yeah. We'll talk a little bit about, this is kind of key to the whole story here. We've never actually done a show, as far as I can recall, on fairies in and of themselves. So I guess, and you know, as you know, because you wrote the book, and as a lot of the listeners know, but it bears sort of fleshing out here on the show. It's like the fairy, the title fairy encompasses a whole bunch of different like elementals and different, you know, all different sorts of you know, ephemeral beings, if you will. So I guess sort of catch people up to speed on that and sort of dispel these, you know, popular notions of what people might think of a fairy when they think fairies. You know, they think of like Tinkerbell or something like that. It's really quite different than the Disneyfication of this.
Right. The term really was sort of co-opted in a lot of this Victorian art and a lot of popular culture. We hear the term fairy and we automatically write it off as something silly and fanciful and something that really has no basis in reality. It's almost, to a lot of people, like saying dragon or unicorn.
Yeah.
But the truth of the matter is that there are these really rich histories of elemental beings throughout the world, and a lot of them share similarities in terms of the basic description or a lot of the lore. Part of that is the lore of the exchange of food. Part of that is just the stature or the certain realms that these different elementals inhabit. But in truth, this touchy-feely fairy that we run into in popular culture these days is quite far from what our ancestors used to talk about. The actual fairies of lore could be quite sinister. If you didn't respect them or didn't leave out the proper offerings for them overnight, they could really, really wreak havoc on your home or your luck or even your life. They inhabited the air and the water and the rocks and the mountains and literally every continent where there is where there have been what traditionally people would call primitive people, there is a fairy tradition, and they come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. I think at one point in the book I mentioned I compare the elaborate taxonomy of fairies to like a catalog of Pokemon,
right?
Because
yeah.
They all have these very specific traits and attributes, and you know, you can't give this one fairy this thing because they'll get mad, and you can't give it that other thing because it'll get mad. You have to give it specific things in specific ways, or it will wreak specific havoc on you. So,
right.
You know, there are the Wood Woes, which is the hairy wild man, which a lot of people compare to Sasquatch, Portuguese Duendes, Chinese Mogwai, the Minahune of Hawaii, the Little Men of Cherokee lore. The list goes on and on, not even to mention what we're mostly familiar with, which are the Celtic and Scandinavian fairies, like the Brownies and the Hidden Folk. So there's this rich tradition, and if you really take a step back and look at it, the similarities between fairy lore and alien lore are so incredibly striking, and I seriously recommend anyone interested to check out Jacques Vallée's Passport to Magonia, which I believe has just been reissued. It's a wonderful, seminal work on a lot of these connections.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's remarkable, the whole fairy thing. It's kind of one of those like in crowd things in the esoteric world. You know what I mean? If you know someone who's into this stuff, they know that the elementals are a whole different thing. But if you ask them, a normal person, about fairies, they're like, they just think Tinkerbell. You know, it's kind of crazy like that.
Exactly, and it's one of those things. I mean, there's so many aspects to Fortiana that has been, again, to use the term, co-opted by certain movements. So the New Age movement and the fantasy animated film movements have really just taken this fairy ball and run with it and changed it into something completely different than what it is. But, I've always had a really here's a ridiculous thing for a 30-year-old man to say. I've always had a really deep interest in fairies because it's always been this weird, quirky thing that no one – I know, right? Me and my Lisa Frank, Trapper Keeper.
Yeah, you set me up to laugh when you said
no, I've always had a – I know, I'm trying to be nice and not make you laugh too much. I've always had an interest in this because it's spoken to a lot of the things that I've always found attractive, which are this idea of things being just different, slightly behind the veil, you know. And that really, I think, taps into that. And it plays into the alien mythos as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. I got to warn people now. I have a little piece of cotton in my mouth while I have a cigarette because I had mouth surgery today, so bear with me. Well, here's the key part of the story that I found interesting. Let me get that out of there. All right. Talk about this whole thing, because this is like the critical part of the whole of the book, I thought, is this Foyson concept. It kept coming up over and over again in the book, and I felt like it was like the biggest, like, I don't know, I don't want to call it like a MacGuffin, but it was like this mysterious thing that I never quite could wrap my head around. Do you know what I mean? It was like the thing in the briefcase in Pulp Fiction. It was like, what is this thing that, you know, so talk, I guess, define this Foyson and bring people up to speed on it. I mean, if I was just going to do sort of a brief thumbnail on it, it's like, somehow the idea in the folklore is that the fairies can take, like, the essence, the nutritional essence or something from food, and that's their food. And then the food is left behind for humans, and it's worthless. It's got no taste or whatever. I don't understand it quite exactly, but it has no oomph, if you will.
Yeah, it's this really strange concept.
It's very nebulous, so it's hard to kind of put your mind around. But, yeah, please enlighten me more about the Foyson.
No, and I totally agree. It's one of these things that seems very central to it, but you can't really quite get any you can't really wrestle down an answer as to exactly what Foyson is, short of people just saying it's the essence of food. There's a Welsh term that that is unpronounceable for me that I'm not going to try to say, which is a similar. It's a synonym for Foyson, but the Foyson really is the essence or the energy of the food. And you can find parallels to this in Arabic lore with the jinn, who supposedly eat the energy of food as well. In a lot of literature, food without its Foyson is still consumable, but you shouldn't eat it. Cats who would eat food without its Foyson would become sick, or animals would become ill. Basically, what this is it allows the fairies to take out the essence of food without touching it or actually consuming it. Now, I have a pretty mean skeptical streak in the honest, true word of the term, true meaning of the word skeptic.
Mm-hmm.
Micah Hanks talks about big S skeptics and small S skeptics. Well, you know, I'm a small S skeptic. I'm not someone who just writes things off. I have to admit, this concept of Foyson sounds like a way to explain why offerings left out for fairies don't disappear. You know, I left the milk out for the pixies and it's still there in the morning. Well, they took its Foyson, so you shouldn't drink it. We should just pour it out. But again, you find this consistency across different cultures that talk about this. And there are plenty of stories that say that, you know, there was this ox in the field, and even though it looked okay, the fairies had actually come along and disassembled the ox and taken, you know, a haunch of meat and put it back together, and you'd never know, except the cow walks with a little bit of a limp now, but the fairies took the voice and took the essence. Where this gets really fascinating for me is that there are a lot of Robert Kirk in his treatise, The Secret Commonwealth, mentions how the fairy folk tend to absorb Foyson through their spongous skin, which touches on some things that I go into in the book about how some people claim that extraterrestrials actually absorb food through their skin. So it's another one of these weird parallels. I guess I didn't really answer what the hell Foyson is, did I?
Well, like I said, it's very nebulous. Is there any like scientific connection we can make to this? Because to me, it's like you said, the skeptical part of you is like, there's no, the food's still the food. So, is there anything in the world of science that maybe has it's hard to really come up with the right words here, but has like the sort of connection to what we could maybe apply to this voice and idea, or is it a completely sort of supernatural concept?
As far as I can tell, it's pretty much supernatural. I mean, there are plenty of cultural parallels. Dia de los Muertos ceremonies in Latin America often have relatives of deceased loved ones taking back the offerings at the end of the night because their deceased loved ones have taken the foison out of it. You look at the Irish tradition of the sin eater, which has some parallels with this, the food being imbued with a certain meaning. But as far as something in a hard science standpoint, it just really I haven't been able to find anything. I think of maybe caloric value, or I just don't know.
I'm thinking of.
I do think it's.
I could have sworn I heard somewhere that if you like boil vegetables, they lose their nutritional value or something like that. So maybe there's a connection like there, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's what's that old saying? I'm in Georgia, and there's a saying that we don't boil our vegetables until they're ready. We boil them until they're dead. And you eat until you're tired, not until you're full. It's interesting that you bring that up, too, because I go in later in the book into the subject of fairy ointments, which some people said that fairy ointment, which allows you to see the fairies if you rub on your eyes, can actually be produced by boiling eggs in water and using the water as a sort of ointment. So I think you might definitely be onto something there with the idea of boiling, sort of extracting something from the food. But, again, coming back to this, I can't pin down what this food essence really is. I think that there's plenty of anecdotal and cultural analogs for it. I think that there's a parallel between the way that animals should avoid or do avoid food missing its foison, and you find scavengers avoiding cattle mutilations and not eating the remains of mutilated cattle. But as far as a hard science's answer, I can't. You're right. It's this nebulous big question mark that's at the center of the whole thing.
Right, right. It's hard, and you can't really go to like a scientist and be like, "Can you study foison?" They'd like throw you out. So that's not happening.
I mean, if you really want to be generous, I mean, you could say that it perhaps is a ancient concept for describing caloric value. Is just spitballing that idea. Which just literally came to me.
Yeah. Because they wouldn't know all. Yeah, they didn't really know all that stuff back then, I presume. So.
Exactly. So that's the closest thing that I can think of.
Interesting. All right. Well, that connects to kind of what I picked up from reading the book is that. In all these instances of the fairies give these people, I guess, you know what, let's kind of like, I guess, sort of give people a little bit of a thumbnail, a little bit of a bring them up to speed kind of moment here. And I guess talk a little bit about the sorts of foods that have been reported exchanged in these situations. So I guess more often than not, it's the entity, for lack of a better term, giving the food to the human, but or offering the food to the human. But I guess detail what the various types of foods, because it's a whole myriad of stuff, which is really remarkable too. But like I said, catch people up to speed a little bit so they kind of know what we're talking about here.
Oh no, I'd be glad to. It's quite interesting how sometimes there are these strong correlations and sometimes there are some weaker correlations. But it really depends on the entity. You look at fairy folklore and it's almost always. The fairy is offering someone a liquid, usually a wine or a punch or an ale or bread. And, of course, logically, that makes sense for that time period. Both were staples. Water was usually less sanitary to drink than alcoholic products. And bread, of course, was a staple, especially of the lower classes. You take a look at that, and there's that trend. That's quite strong. You wouldn't expect them in medieval times for fairies to give someone a mango or a pomegranate. So
right.
That makes enough sense. In alien lore, it's overwhelmingly liquids. Liquids are what people tend to report. Breaking down from that, there's a little bit of a spike with contactee cases for people to receive fruits. And not to say that breads and other things aren't received as well, but it's really interesting. Abductee cases are usually liquids and are usually consumed under duress.
Right.
And contactee cases are usually either sweet, wonderful fruit juice or some sort of fruit, always consumed voluntary with some sort of promise that eat this and your vibrations will raise or something along those lines. And then Sasquatch, again, we've sort of addressed this a little bit about how Sasquatch has some similarities in terms of the lore around him, but in the actual application is a little bit of an outlier. Tends to give vegetables and raw meat. But even then, raw meat is less prominent on the spectrum than vegetables. One would assume if you adopt the idea that Sasquatch is a biological ape, that the reason that it isn't giving out liquid is because it can't make a cup or can't have a cup.
Right, right. That's why it's not giving them bread either. You know, it's, it can't be baking bread or anything like that.
Right, yeah. And you run into a couple of stories here and there where somebody extrapolates that Sasquatch is giving them bread because they stole it, but the lion's share of Sasquatch lore is either vegetables or, you know, or meat, usually in the form of roots and frogs and, you know, small mice and such things. It's interesting. This whole subject as a whole is I feel like there's still a lot of depth that you could go into on it, because this book is primarily about the exchange of food. So entities giving witnesses food and witnesses giving entities food, and even not so much the latter, mostly just entities giving witnesses food and trying to break apart that question. So there are these trends taken as a whole between the three separate categories, fairies, aliens, and Sasquatch, literally over 60% of the cases involve liquid, which I think has some implications to exactly what we're dealing with. Why I say exactly what we're dealing with is because this is not for nourishment. Maybe in some of these Sasquatch cases it is, because they've abducted some girl that they want to have their, you know, some sort of Sasquatch baby mama. and they just want to keep them alive. But, you know, a lot of these others are short encounters where somebody's given a liquid and told to drink it and they leave. Well, sometimes that's the entire purpose of the visit. So this is not an issue of sustenance. This is an issue of these beings giving witnesses food for some ulterior motive. And the question is, what is that ulterior motive and what role does this food have in that?
Right, exactly. Well, it's interesting because one of the things that stood out to me and what kind of I have next to Foyce in here in the notes is, you know, you share these stories of the fairy food instances of fairies giving food to people and stuff. And then it sort of takes a weird little turn as it's kind of revealed that there are then cases where they somehow like either remember what the food really looked like, or let's just say the veil is lifted on the food, for lack of a better term. And it turns out it's like bark and trash and stuff it's not a cookie. It turns out it's like, you know, I don't even know. It's scat. So it's like, why, what is going on here? Why these fairies are like tricking them, it seems, into eating something that really isn't a delightful treat.
Yeah, you know, it's again this curious tendency for these phenomena to engage in theater and metaphor and deception. And I do think that there's a connection between this idea of food lacking any nutritional value and fairy food being revealed to be substances of no nutritional value. I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, if fairies take the foison out of milk and it has no nutritional value, and a fairy were to give you fairy milk, and the fairy milk were revealed to be twigs and bark, as it is in a lot of his legends, well, twigs and bark have no nutritional value. I guess what I'm getting at, I think there's a slight parallel there. But yeah, almost every time, it's always some sort of detritus that's been cloaked with glamour or illusion to make it appear much more appealing than it is. And you run into this in a lot of, there's some Scandinavian folk tales where heroes are in the underworld and they see frogs and worms inside of their cup, their tankard of ale. Or there was actually a Welsh saint named Saint Colin who visited the king of the fairies in the 7th century and saw the food and said, "I do not eat the leaves of a tree." Was and you know, on sort of a riff on that, witches at their witches' Sabbaths would apparently eat and eat and eat and return nonetheless hungry for all their feasting. So again, I like to find these threads between these different subjects and sort of tug on it and see what happens.
Exactly. Yeah. It definitely makes you wonder how much of these fairy experiences are like just straight up, I don't want to say hallucinations, but like, fabrications, not of the witness, but a fabrication of the intelligence, if you will, whatever is out there that's making this happen to the person.
No, and you know there are some people that this book will appeal to very much because of the direction that the information leads me, and I feel like we're really getting down to brass tacks here, Tim. I feel like if you take a look at a lot of altered states of consciousness and a lot of things that we would straight up consider hallucinations, there are a lot of parallels between those and a lot of the things that people report. Hmm. And I know that there are a lot of parallels that people are aware of and, you know, hallucinations and altered states of consciousness and fairy reports or alien reports. But even in Sasquatch lore, there's some of that there too. You know, people saying that they're paralyzed, or in some cases saying that they receive telepathic messages from Sasquatch. You know, I personally want Sasquatch to be a flesh and blood creature. But if I'm honest with myself, when I look at the data, I have to admit that there's some peculiar similarities there too. Something that, you know, I know Greg Bishop has talked a lot about, another gentleman that I admire very, very much in this field, is this concept of, you know, co-creation. How much of this is what the entity is producing, and how much of this is what, you know, you bring to the experience yourself.
Right.
And I think that the truth is probably somewhere in between. You know, we grow up in this Western materialist society where everything has to be internal or external, you know, physical or non-physical, hallucination or real, objective or subjective. And I think there might be some things that are really kind of in between.
Mm. Absolutely, yeah. Well, this seems to straddle the line, for sure, especially this fairy stuff. Now, would you say, now you looked at all these cases, so, I mean, I noticed there were some in the book that were from relatively recent times as far as food exchange cases, but, I mean, is it as much of a prominent thing nowadays, or is it something that kind of is, you know, more sort of within the fairy lore era, if you will?
What's most popularized in the fairy lore? I mean, you look at the food taboo, this idea that accepting food from an entity will trap you with them. That only explicitly comes up in fairy lore and some Sasquatch legends, and in a handful of alien abductee cases and contactee cases, they're told you can't eat this or you'll be trapped here with us forever, or something like that. I mean, this gets into a couple of different issues. If you're asking simply about the receiving of food or drinks or other substances, absolutely all the way up until the modern day. As I was writing this book, I would listen to different podcasts, and I would hear people talking about this in other cases. And I'd go, well, I need to add that. I'd like to add that. I'd like to incorporate that. Because that's, yeah. By the way, anyone who wants to write a book, just live this stuff. Like, listen to 10 hours of it a day, and you'll have half your book written just by picking up on different threads. So that's a huge tip that I wish somebody had told me. And start here on Banal of America. If you look at our foods being exchanged in, for example, alien abductee reports, absolutely all the time. We don't hear about a ton of contemporary Sasquatch abductions, but in the ones from the past, you know, 50 years or older, yeah, it happens. Again, no explicit food taboos in alien lore, but you've got to sort of take apart this idea of what does it mean to be trapped forever in fairyland. Does that mean you're literally trapped in a physical realm forever? Or does it mean that your life will be changed forever? Does it mean that you'll have to live with being an abductee for the rest of your life? Does it mean that you'll go insane? Does it mean that you'll commit suicide? I think all of these could be perceived as variations on the concept of being trapped in fairyland, as it were.
Yeah.
So, as with everything in the field of Fortiana, you are sort of left with this massive amount of data and no idea of quite how to parse it out, you know.
Mm.
Categorization was an issue that I ran into with this book. You know, are ointments part of, you know, are they part of the food exchange? Because they're a substance that is ingested through the skin. Is that a variation on this trope? You know, if an alien gives you a pill and drops it into a glass of water and it changes the water into some sort of different color, is that considered an alien food, or is it a human food that was turned alien? You know, So there are a lot of really gray areas, which is part one of the reasons that this is not a quantitative analysis of this phenomena. I think the unexplained needs more quantitative analysis. Unfortunately, I can't figure out a way to do it with this. So it's a very qualitative interpretation of the data.
How are you supposed to? Yeah, it's a tough thing to really study in that way. So it's really, you know what I mean? It's really, like you say in the book too, it's like the reports vary in levels of strength. You know what I mean? Where some people just mention they ate something and they don't really even get into it. And then other people talk about the color, the taste, all this other stuff. So it's like, how can you really do a sort of a science, you know, I don't mean statistical or whatever sort of like you said, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge frustration that I ran into. Is one of the worst things that I hated to read was they remembered eating something. I'm just like, no, give me some sort of data. Luckily, those are few and far between, and I think more importantly and to the point, there's a difference between people remembering they ate something and they drank something, and I think that's, again, one of the clearest trends, one of the things that I can say I'm absolutely comfortable with being a conclusion that I've made is that most of these cases of all kinds involve liquids. Yeah, sorry, and again, pardon me if I'm getting a little rambly. Part of the reason that I decided to write this book was you know, I'd gotten into this subject a lot, and I kept on listening to these podcasts, and I really want people to talk to. So if I get over enthusiastic or if I wax over long, please feel free to cut me off.
No, don't worry about it, dude. You're doing great. I'm a little off my game tonight because I said before the show started, I had a molar pulled.
I appreciate it. You're being a champ.
Like 5 hours ago, so I'm a little I'm really thrown off. But I'm relatively in the zone here, so we're all good. What I thought interesting, you know, you talk about the difficulty in the qualitative part of it all, or quantitative. I get those confused all the time, but. To jump to what I was going to say, I thought it was interesting you mentioned that Puerto Rico has an inordinate amount of food cases. Makes you wonder what that's all about.
Yeah, and I think that there is, you know, if you look at this from a psychological standpoint, I think that cultures that have a lot of social gatherings and a lot of emphasis on food might be more prone to report these sort of encounters. Or if you look at it as like a nuts and bolts ET sort of thing, if you're visiting a culture that is more puts a great value on food, you might use food. So either way, I think that the culture of where this is has a strong role to play. Latin America in total is rife with these reports. And you know, you think about the way that you know, how food has become treated in Western society. I mean, so much of what we eat is fast food, and we eat while we're watching TV. It's no longer really a social interaction anymore. We're eating more and more quote unquote delicious stuff and taking less and less time to actually, you know, enjoy it. Which, again, I'm just completely speculating here, but I think that might have something to do with it. As far as the spike, why this little island would have such a spike in reports. I'm completely at a loss. Of course, Puerto Rico has a rich Fortean tradition anyway, with a lot of UFO reports in the past. And I think Nick Redfern's about to release a book on his trips to Puerto Rico looking for chupacabras. So.
Yeah, it's got quite the history down there. It was just surprising that it popped up again. And to speak to what you were saying here about sort of Western culture and the fast food and everything, that's kind of what I was getting at in a way when I was asking about, you know, how we have a lot of these sort of fairy lore cases. You wonder about modern cases. It's like there wasn't any case in the book where an alien or an elemental being or whatever sort of like offered somebody McDonald's or anything. You know what I mean? It's like interesting. There's no like sort of modern kind of like equivalent to what the fairy lore is talking about in that sense.
Yeah, it's bizarre. You know, you look around at Western culture and there's so much meat and so much candy, you'd think that if this was a psychological phenomena or flights of fancy, people would say that they were receiving meat. But I can literally count on like two hands the number of cases that I could find that really that involved meat. I did find couple of non-credible reports mentioning hamburgers, but you know, you look at the things that people are getting, and it's healthy foods,
right?
It's liquids, it's fruits, it's breads, it's definitely non-fattening stuff, which is, you know, fascinating to me. It really is.
Yeah, yeah. It speaks to, I mean, I don't even know. I don't understand it. It's really, I feel like there's, we kind of danced around it because we don't want to give away too much sort of like the ultimate idea of the book, but it's like the whole thing kind
know,
of,
right?
Like speaks to this idea of like, there's so much more going on than an actual food exchange. It's not, like you said before, it's not for sustenance. It's not like they're like, hey, you look like you're hungry. Here, have something. It's like they're up to something by asking you to eat it. And it's almost like you wonder if there's some kind of other, sort of like the Black Eyed Kids thing where it's like you have to let them in the house. They can't just force their way in. I wonder if it's sort of like that, at least in the fairy lore thing, where it's like, they want you to eat the food or take the drink because something's going to happen to you, but they can't outright do it to you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a Trojan Feast was not my initial title, but Patrick came back with the idea of a Trojan Feast, which has some wonderful shades of John Keel in there, which I like as well.
Hmm.
But I think that sort of does speak to the central thesis point of the book. And yeah, we're trying to dance around it. I always remember when I'm listening to the podcast, I'm like, damn it, just tell me what your thesis is. but I think what it really comes down to is, you know, I wrestled a lot, Tim, when I was writing this book about, you know, should I even be looking for these similarities? Because if it's like, is this like someone saying, I saw the entity breathe. Oh my gosh, all entities are breathing. You know?
Right.
Or,
right.
You know, I saw the entity with eyes. Oh my gosh, there's a similarity. All these entities have eyes. But where I finally landed on that was there is no reason why you should have a 30-minute encounter with any of these things and you should be given a pill, or you should have a 30-minute encounter with any of these things and you should be given a drink, or even, you know, heck, I mean, what's the rule of four in human biology? You can last for 4 minutes without air, 4 days without water, and 4 weeks without food, approximately. There's no reason that people should be given food and drink with such consistency, or at least with such regularity.
Mm. It doesn't make any sense. They're up to something. That's kind of the point, folks. They're up to something. We don't even know. We don't know what they're up to, but they're using food to make it happen.
Sneaky, cheeky bastards.
Yeah, yeah. It's really eerie. Now, I guess the most famous story in UFO lore of all this sort of idea is this Joe Simonton's pancakes. And I'd heard the story a few times, and I'm sure, like, people listening, I'd bet more than half of the people listening have heard the story before. But for the minority of folks who haven't heard it, I guess give us a little sort of thumbnail on the Joe Simonton story, because I'm intrigued by this, because it seems like, well, this happened, like, you know, relatively recently as compared to the fairy lore stuff, and it's like something tells me you can't get those pancakes nowadays. You can't even find them. They're completely gone. No one even knows where they are. But tell the story, and then I'll pepper you with some follow-up questions where I rant.
All right, sounds good. Yeah, the Joe Simonton case is near and dear to my heart, because not only is it the most famous of all these entity food cases when you mention someone getting food or drink from alien, but it took place in Wisconsin, which is where I did my undergraduate work, and it is also the poster child that Jacques Vallée used to really underscore a lot of the similarities between alien lore and fairy folklore.
Mm-hmm.
It was April 18th, I believe, in 1961, and Joe Simonton, who was a chicken farmer from Eagle River, Wisconsin, was inside his house when he heard some sort of strange sound like tires on wet pavement coming from outside. He looked outside, and there was this silver machine that came down and landed in the yard, and it was about 30 feet wide, shaped like two inverted bowls, so a pretty classic flying saucer shape, and he took a look, and a hatch popped open and revealed three dark-skinned entities that he called Italians. They had some sort of knit headwear, were about 5 feet tall, and had dark outfits. And one of them was sort of communicating through pantomime. It held a shiny jug in the air, and Simonton took the jug and went back inside and filled it up with water and brought it out. When he brought it out, he noticed that there was one of the creatures to the side was frying food on some sort of griddle. And apparently these things noticed him flipping these alien flapjacks, and they offered Simonson three of the pancakes. And, you know, you mentioned how you can't find those anymore. Yeah, I haven't been able to figure out what happened to them. Everybody really, I'm sorry, four pancakes, not three. Everybody seemed to think that Simonson was above reproach, and, you know, he was from what I can understand, he was simple, and I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, just in terms of an honest, good old Wisconsin farmer, Midwestern guy, just right. Like, why would I have any reason to, you know, make this up? You know, he gave one of the pancakes to a local judge, one to J. Allen Hynek, and one to the National Investigation Committee on Aerial Phenomena. And he kept one for himself, and he took a bite of it and said it tasted like cardboard, which, again, sort of ties into this idea of alien food being detritus. It ties into this idea of alien food lacking its foison, its nutritive substance. Something that I found really interesting, and I've mentioned this to a couple of people because it's my go-to tidbit that I learned that was one of the most exciting things that spurred me on to continue this book, is that there's a tradition of fairies in the Netherlands who will visit farmers in the field and will give them pancakes and fresh water whenever they're getting too tired. So that's a nice little connection there between alien lore and fairy lore that I thought was really interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, it just makes you wonder, like I said, where all this stuff ended up in the first, like, after it's all said and done. You know what I mean? What happened? I guess the pancake really wouldn't last, theoretically, all those years anyway, but...
Yeah, but you'd think that it would be, I mean, it's being an artifact. I mean, if this was a chunk of Roswell memory metal, we'd be all over it like white on rice. And yet somehow these just sort of fell through the cracks. Supposedly there was an analysis done by the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, and they said it was just terrestrial ingredients like hydrogenated oil and buckwheat. Today you'll find there are some rumors that there was an unknown mystery grain that was used, but I've never found anything concrete to really back that up. Yeah. If anybody out there knows of a report or some sort of provenance that suggests that, I would be thrilled to find out about it. But you know, the U.S. Air Force said that he was just making breakfast and fell asleep or something, which is a ridiculous suggestion for me.
Yeah, that is a ridiculous suggestion. That's like swamp gas. That's just it's amazing what they could get away with back then. They just would say, and people would be like, "Oh, okay, yeah, that's probably true."
Yep. Yeah.
You point out in the book, and I thought this was, I kind of picked up on this as I was reading too, and I was glad you mentioned it. So it's surprising you say that there aren't too many reports of unearthly food. Let's say it's like if these are like not just the aliens, but let's face it. A fairy would, I don't know if necessarily by definition it's an extraterrestrial, but it's certainly sort of like an other. What do you got going on over there? What, are you emptying the dishwasher?
Oh, me?
Yeah.
I just grabbed some ice. Sorry, I'm refilling.
He's doing chores. He's doing chores in the middle
of
the show.
I'm so disinterested. Sorry about that.
It's
that
all
was,
right.
That was rather rude.
It's no, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. I've had worse. So.
All right.
So it's like the fairies and stuff, they're as elemental beings and whatnot, it's like theoretically they would have different kind of like compositions, they would eat different kind of foods, but it's like, especially with the ETs as well, but they eat, in these stories, if we're to believe how they all go down, they eat normal human food. It's like, that doesn't make any sense. It seems like it's paradoxical in a way.
Well, I mean, it's sort of this paradox that we've always run into with our interactions with the other. Every one of these things is anthropomorphic. It's human-like. You know, you run into a gray alien and it has eyes and a nose and a mouth. And, you know, there's not really, as alien as aliens are supposed to be, by and large, they don't appear that alien. And you'd think that there would be some difference in biology between, maybe not Sasquatch again, the outlier, that whole anthropoid ape idea. But you'd think that aliens or even fairies would have some sort of different culinary art at the very least, but people are receiving foods that have a very direct analog. You know, people aren't saying, wow, I got this sort of weird, indescribable thing. I mean, granted, there are some cases like that where people are like, they gave me this weird orange sphere that was glowing and it tasted like a, you know, tasted like something, but I don't know what it was.
Right.
But for the most part, people are saying, hey, they gave me a giant strawberry.
Or, yeah, yeah.
You know, or, hey, they gave me something that tasted like cough syrup. Like, there are very, very, very clear comparisons to be made between earthly food and this. And again, you've got to think about, you know, I mentioned how alien abductions usually involve substances consumed under duress. You'd think that if, you know, if you can do all this stuff, if you can paralyze folks and enter their minds and abduct them from their bedrooms at night and no one notice and all these things, that would they really have to resort to giving somebody a pill?
Yeah.
You know? Injections maybe make sense if you're a really hardline ETH guy. Injections make sense, but, you know, there's no reason that an alien would say, you know, here's a, you know, a pint of yellow liquid, you've got to drink it. You know, you think that there would be other means of doing this. So does that, to me, that seems to indicate, it seems to point to the idea that the pageantry is the point. The pageantry of this particular interaction is the reason why it's happening.
Yeah, exactly. Goes back to the whole idea of, like, these people don't really need the food for the most part, you know, in these situations.
Right.
It's very perplexing. I'm really glad you wrote the book, though, because it's an interesting sort of avenue to go down and look at, because, like I said, it's been there forever, but it's been existing on the peripheral of the paranormal for so long that I don't think nobody ever really took the time to sort of, like, compile it all together in one shot.
Yeah, I had reached out when I was sort of feeling out this idea, because I had no idea that I could do this. You know, I was sort of like, oh, write a book. Are you kidding me? That's a lot of work. And, you know, so many people are having to self-publish or even not be published at all and this and that, you know, sort of being my own worst enemy. But I reached out to Micah Hanks because I feel like I have a sort of connection with Micah, and that we're both North Carolinians, and you know, we both were raised in the Episcopal Church, and we both have just, like, you know, a lot of similarities between our lives. We're both musicians. And I mentioned this, and he was really enthusiastic about there being enough material there. And, you know, I was talking to him, and I said, has anybody really done this? And, you know, he said, no. You know, there have been people who have mentioned the similarity in chapters, or the similarity of the food taboo or being given food in passing, but no one has ever dedicated, you know, made a book and, you know, done a survey of this literature and tried to make some sense of why it's happening like this. So I feel very, very blessed to have had this opportunity. And, I huge thanks to Micah, huge thanks to Red Pill Junkie. And, like I said, mentioned earlier, Patrick Weege and folks like yourself who were part of the inspiration for this in the first place.
Nice. Well, I really had nothing to do with it, but I'll take credit. My pleasure, Joshua. Red Pill Junkie's in the chat room, so I'm sure he'll be doing some backflips in a moment. Now, talk about absorption theory. Is this your theory, absorption theory, or are you sort of just kind of like putting a name to the idea here? I've kind of heard the idea. I guess let's just get into it. Talk about absorption theory. Sorry, man.
Okay. No. That's fine. Yeah, I guess. Okay, so it's my first book, so I might as well start making enemies.
Good start.
David Jacobs claimed. Yeah, David Jacobs claimed in his 1998 book Threat that the absorption theory was kind of. Well, he didn't directly claim that it was his pet theory. He's the one who coined the term the absorption theory.
Okay, so I was kind of wondering because I was like, did I miss this somewhere? That's why I was asking I wasn't trying to put you on the spot by saying like, or did you make it up? It was just kind of like you referenced it, and I was like, where the hell? How did I miss this absorption theory all these years? So now I know why, because I, you know, David Jacobs.
No. The reason that it came to my attention in the first place was there was this November 2005 editorial in Magonia by Martin Kottmeyer. Who was sort of taking issue with the fact that David Jacobs said, we now know that the aliens obtain fuel differently from humans.
Yes, I saw that part of the book. Yeah.
So he was really picking that statement apart, saying, we now know and we now know, you know, taking apart those two parts of those two aspects, like as if we can know anything about this.
Right. I had a real problem with that too. Know? Yeah, actually. So,
yeah. I mean, whenever somebody talks with certainty about what they know or about what they are sure is happening or going on with any of this stuff, my bullshit needle like buries into the red, like
right.
It just explodes.
Right.
But that aside, even suggesting that it was a relatively new idea in 1998, it's far-fetched because there's been plenty of anecdotal evidence for this idea. So the idea of the absorption theory, now that we're finally getting to what your original question, is the idea that extraterrestrials, if we accept the biological extraterrestrial hypothesis, actually don't consume food in the way that humans do. The idea is that they actually absorb it through the skin in some form or fashion. And this is pointed to, you know, there's plenty of anecdotal evidence for that conclusion. Small slit-like mouths, the apparent lack of an anus or genitalia in a lot of these cases. But the idea has been around for quite a long time. I go into the book about, you know, a lot of the things that people have said, but, you know, you look at even, I mean, prior to what David Jacobs said in John Max, let me make sure I get this date right. In John Max, Passport to the Cosmos.
It's all right.
The other one.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry. Mentioned some of his abductees seeing, alien fetuses being sponged with a green liquid. Phil Corso's book, The Day After Roswell, mentions a similar interaction. If, say what you want to about that book, the idea was out there that aliens absorb stuff through their skin. Even the Krill report from back in 1988 mentioned it as well. So this idea has been around for a while. And the reason that it's really important and germane to our discussion, because, again, this book isn't about what aliens eat or what Sasquatch eat. It's about the exchange. So how does this have any bearing on the exchange? Well, if these entities are eating through their skin, in the case of aliens today, why do they have these other foods on hand? You know, why do they have liquids that are to be consumed orally? Why do they have bread? Why do they have fruit? Why are there any of these very terrestrial things on hand if it's not, you know, part of their supply? It has to be for us. And, it has to be, so either you accept the idea that they have a container of dog treats or something for us, the equivalent of dog treats, or again, this is not what it seems. So that's sort of a little riff on the whole idea, and this idea of the absorption theory again ties into Foyson, which, as I mentioned, Robert Kirk said that fairies tended to absorb the foison at a distance through their skin, which was very sponges. So. Mm.
Foison. I want some of that foison, man.
I know. Every time I say foison, I feel like it's one of the Three Stooges. Poison. Oh, give me some foison.
Well, someone in the chat room was like, what the hell are they talking about? What is this foison? How do you spell that? So...
Yeah,
it's a very weird
idea. And to that point, in case anybody runs across it, yes, I'm very well aware that there are some accounts of fairies eating pure meat, pure water and raw meat. But you look at a lot of the other literature by Briggs and Evans Wentz and some of those other folks, and they all point to this foison concept. So that's what I mainly focused on for the book.
Seems like it's been around for a while, so. Well, it's very, it's interesting stuff. Let me take a look at my notes here, what I had on here. I felt bad. I laughed at the Ted Rice story where he was,
Oh, man, that has to be the most uncomfortable thing that I've ever put on paper, man.
Tell people about this story, because...
Do I have to, Tim?
Okay, no, all right. I'll exempt you. I'll share part of the story. Somehow he's like has a dream where he's like with his grandmother or something, and his dead grandfather comes and has sex with his grandmother right in front of him, and then the grandfather turns into a reptile, and then he has to have sex with the reptile, and then a whole bunch of reptiles rape
awful.
Him. I'm sorry, but it was just hilarious to me. I'm just,
yeah,
I have gallows humor, I guess, but I was just like, dude, what is wrong with you? Oh,
yeah,
man.
It's one of those things where you read it, and it's just this perfect marriage of one of the most horrifying things, if it's true, and some of the most absurd things you've ever read, and it's just a super uncomfortable story. But yeah, you got to the gist of it.
Yeah.
And that sort of ties in again. And the reason that that's in the book is because, you know, you can't talk about any of this stuff, even Sasquatch, without getting embroiled in this whole sexuality issue.
Right.
Which seems to crop itself up time and again.
Yeah. Stephanie Quitch, actually, she sent me an email mentioning that about your appearance tonight. Stephanie Quick. And she said she finds it interesting that as a student of anthropology, she's been struck by the two constant exchanges an entity encounters over the centuries, exchanges of food and sex. So it is, they do kind of go hand in hand in a way. And you cover it in the book.
Yeah, I mean, one interesting little line of inquiry that I think could be particularly fruitful in the future is that there was a peer-reviewed article published in a 1996 edition of Psychological Inquiry where some psychologists actually thought that the expression of being forced to eat something or being forced to have something rubbed on the mouth or something in these alien abduction reports was actually a manifestation of oral humiliation, sadomasochistic fantasies.
Hmm.
So,
yeah.
And you look at a lot of, you know, food and sex are essential to survival. One essential to the survival of the individual and one essential to the survival of the species. They're both urges that everyone has. And, you know, they're both, you know, you look at a lot of the language that we use about our lovers. I want to eat you up. I could just devour you. You know, there's a lot of connections there.
Let me see.
Or as in have you seen Superbad?
Yeah.
The movie Superbad?
Yeah. Yeah,
I remember Jonah Hill's character says all the good foods are shaped like dicks.
Yeah.
he's talking about hot dogs. But yeah.
Exactly,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, there's this connection, yeah. So.
Now, we talked about the food that these fairies and other beings like, but I thought it was interesting, too. You picked up an interesting sort of exception to the rule, if you will, and that was salt. Salt being sort of used and coming up over and over again as sort of the kryptonite of sorts against these entities.
Yeah, that's a really great way to put it. Salt is pretty rare in a lot of these encounters. I think that you could absolutely just write a book on the presence of salt in a lot of these in its relationship to the paranormal. One of the most commonly heard things is that salt would help fend off the fairies, and a lot of people have speculated, well, maybe this means that, you know, since salt prevents decay, maybe it means that it somehow prevents, you know, the fairies who have long been associated with the dead from being able to approach you, or, you know, maybe it has something to do with the fact that in the painting of The Last Supper, Judas has knocked over the salt on the table. You know, people have speculated as to exactly why this is, but in any case, a lot of cultures have felt that salt is really important to keeping away the fairies, and you don't find it, accordingly, you don't find it in a lot of these entity food reports.
Hmm.
A few of the ones that I did find were, you know, had some pretty good evidence against them as being hoaxes or as being, you know, mistaken lucid dreams or something along those lines.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. There's, you know, tales of, there's one tale of a Celtic prince whose lover is taken away to fairyland, and every night he goes and tries to dig his way to fairyland, and he comes back the next day and his work has been completely reversed until he finally has the smart idea of putting down a ring of salt and digging in the ring of salt, and the fairies can't actually cross over the ring of salt to reverse his work. So,
what was I going to ask you just now? I lost my train of thought here on this one. Yeah, Red Pill Junkie says the salt thing is very weird, very universal. So I agree, it is very universal. Oh, that's
I was just going to say, Red Pill, if anybody wants to look into this, he wrote a great article on Mysterious Universe several months back about some other aspects of the whole salt thing that I really recommend. It's great stuff.
He's a great writer, that Red Pill Junkie. He's awesome. Now, what I was going to say,
he's an all right guy.
What I was going to say is the thought rolled back into my head here. It was interesting. You mentioned Soma in the book, and this is like this. I think it was like an ancient spice or something, or an ancient plant. But they don't know. That's the point. They don't know, and that kind of ties in to sort of like a broader point, and that is just we have to draw inferences from a lot of this stuff that we're dealing with as far as the fairy lore stuff goes, because we're sort of dealing with human accounts of things that they encountered, but from also from a long time ago where we may not even be interpreting it in the right way. Do you know what I mean?
I think you just in terms of how it's all, a lot of these descriptions, a lot of the what we have to go on is based off of the cultural setting. Is that sort of what you're getting at?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, is this, are these, sometimes these fairy stories, are they like just metaphors sort of to not have kids running around in the woods late at night or something like that? You know what I'm saying? And then that goes to sort of the Soma idea, just that, like, in essence, as researchers, as students of all this here in 2015, we're sort of like fumbling around in the dark when we deal with a lot of this stuff, because we don't necessarily know exactly what they were dealing with or what they were trying to say, or in the case of like Soma, what it even was. You know what I mean?
No, I do. You know, it's interesting. A lot of people will say that anthropologists, the traditional explanation for this food taboo, that to take food from the fairies is to remain trapped with them. A lot of them will say that it's a variation on the myth of Persephone, who was tricked by Hades into eating a pomegranate seed as she was being released from the underworld, and she was therefore condemned for the rest of her days to remain in the underworld, with the exception of when she could pop up and visit her mom and bring spring to the earth. The logic behind that is that if mortal food keeps mortals alive, then dead food makes you dead, sustains the dead. But the thing is, I don't see any lesson in a lot of these as parables. Just like I don't really see a lot of lessons to be learned from a lot of modern day abduction reports. I mean, maybe there's a lesson to be learned in terms of don't go driving alone on a dark stretch of road at night, or, you know, or lock your doors. I don't know. Spread salt around your bed.
Yeah.
We're really at a loss for a lot of these things, and Soma is one of those things that I feel like we could have. I'm not even sure that we really, any of the theories that exist out there, because you'll read theories about it being the Amanita muscaria mushroom and a drink made from that. I'm not even sure any of those theories work. I mean, who's saying that this maybe isn't something entirely alien in and of itself, or entirely spiritual in and of itself?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like trying to make heads or tails of a lot of this stuff. It's basically impossible.
How did we even lose the knowledge of what Soma is? Like, what point? Clearly, they knew what it was back when they wrote the Bible. So sometime between, like, when they wrote the Bible and when they printed it, we lost track of what it was. That's so weird that they don't know what it is.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not entirely sure why it was lost to time, and which sort of begs the question to me, at least. You know, has it been lost to time? Was it ever actually something physical ever at all? You know, I feel like it also might be one of those things. I mean, you look at a lot of the things that we take for granted that are just in our society. I think that maybe if we had a book singing the praises of YouTube, I don't know how many actual descriptions of YouTube there would be. You'd find out things that you could see on YouTube, but
right,
it doesn't make
right,
any
yeah.
sense. Like something is such a cultural standard that everybody just assumes that it'll be around forever, but where everybody will know about it, because everybody in our culture knows about it, so, you know, that's all it is. Maybe there's something to do with that, but I don't ever really know if I've ever encountered a good reason for why it was lost to time.
Hmm. Exactly. That's kind of what I was talking about. You made a great example of what I was trying to say about as far as, like, fumbling around in the dark and dealing with these old sources. It's like, we don't know what the hell they're talking about with the Soma thing, so we kind of have to guess about it, but that's the challenge of the research, you know?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the actual Hindu phrases regarding Soma, part of me thinks that maybe it's even a little bit vague as to whether it was an entheogen like ayahuasca, or whether or not it was actually some sort of a metaphorical substance or some sort. You know, I'm not entirely sure that it was a physical beverage. Now, I'm sure that there is someone out there who can. There's a Hindu scholar out there who would, you know, absolutely kick my tail for saying that and saying, like, no, look at this and this and this and this and this. So I may be speaking out of my depth here, but I think we should be in any of these things. I think we should be completely open to any number of alternate suggestions, because, you know, if we can all just admit that we know nothing, then we might actually find out something and know something at the end of the day.
Exactly. That's a great way of putting it, man. That needs to be the attitude of a lot more folks in this field. Red Pill Junkie says, regarding Soma, supposedly the elders realized men were starting to use it for corrupted purposes, so they deliberately ensured the recipe was lost. So,
see, I told you.
That's
somebody knows more than me.
That's what Red Pill Junkie says, so I'll take his word for it. It makes sense. But it's still weird that...
I'll take it.
Still weird that... But who knows? Like you said, in a way, you said, I don't know if you meant it this way, but when you said, how do we know it's been lost? It's like... We don't necessarily know that it's been lost. You know, you talk about, like, conspiracies and secret societies and stuff like that. They may very well know. That may be some part of some kind of ritual or something they don't let us common folk know about.
Yeah, I mean, that's a little bit of what I was alluding to. I mean, it seems like it was such a central aspect of their interaction with the other, that to just go ahead and leave it as sort of this Gnostic knowledge in the hands of a select few and to actually let it die out seems a little bit suspect to me. I have to think that somewhere out there somebody knows definitely what it was.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, you look at a lot of the theories. I mean, Terrence McKenna always said that Amanita muscaria was pretty highly overrated. I myself have never... I've never tried any psychedelics, and I know there's some people who would probably say, if you're going to write about these things, you should, you know, have some applied knowledge of what it is. But,
oh, please.
You know, there are a couple of reasons that I haven't, and some of them are really square. A, they're illegal. I try to avoid things like that. But B, even though I'm a tuba player, I don't exactly have the best respiratory system on the planet, and I have some other health issues. So a little bit of me is just squirrely about the whole thing. But McKenna, who I think, Terrence McKenna, I think, of the world of in terms of a lot of his thinking. For everybody talking about, oh, someone must have been the Amanita muscaria, he said, I've never really had a great experience with it. Nothing even bordering on some of the praises that you read about in the Rig Veda. So,
yeah.
I'm not entirely sure that there's been a great candidate that's been proposed.
No, and it's so far into the realm of the esoteric that it's not like the FDA is trying to figure out what it is or anything like that.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I definitely, like I said earlier, I definitely kind of came out of the book feeling like the Bigfoot was, well, you can't discount the idea, you probably thought about this, but you can't really discount the idea that there's sort of two Bigfoot in a way. You know what I mean? There's the Bigfoot that's like an animal that's running around in the woods, and then there could be elementals that just take on the form of the Bigfoot because they know about the Bigfoot. We don't know about it enough to, you know what I mean, to sort of
yeah, think of it. Absolutely. I mean, you look at, you know, another person who's had a profound influence on me is Mike Cleland, you know, the owl guy.
Uh-huh.
And he's talked a lot about how, you know, a lot of times, sometimes as screen memories or sometimes as literal owls, there's some sort of weird connection between the abduction experience and owls. And he doesn't know if that's beings actually manifesting themselves as owls or beings, you know, communicating through owls. But there's something to be said that, even if you accept the idea that Bigfoot is a biological ape, what if it's just another creature of the forest and as such is subject to being used by these other intelligences? So I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, if people say, oh, you saw a deer and that was a screen memory of a gray because of the big eyes, or oh, you saw an owl and that was a screen memory of a gray or the gray communicating with you. What if it was like, oh, you saw a Bigfoot, and yes, they're a real Bigfoot, but here's, you know, a screen memory of of a Bigfoot as well.
Exactly.
If that makes any sort of sense. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I share a lot of Nick Redford's thoughts on, you know, just as the ETH is a very tidy explanation for a very untidy phenomena, the biological ape theory for Sasquatch is a very tidy answer for a phenomena that has a lot of loose ends that really demand that they be tied up. Again, I would love for Bigfoot to be a biological ape. That sounds so cool. But looking at it objectively, sometimes I kind of have to wonder. So yeah, I don't see, like so many things in these fields, you know, maybe it's both at once. You know, I'm convinced that if we ever do get to the bottom of what UFOs are, we very well might find it's a little bit of everything. It's a little bit of structured craft. It's a little bit of the altered state. It's a little bit of time travel, and it's a little bit of interdimensional, you know, things going on as well. You know?
Yeah, I think, well, the interesting thing, too, there's always a possibility, once we solve one of these things, then the rest all fall like dominoes, too. That's kind of what I'm hoping for.
Well, you know, I said a funny thing to Micah. We got together for lunch this past November, and I mentioned to him, and I'm not sure if he really agreed with me, but I just want to say something controversial, which was, I feel like we have all the puzzle pieces on the table. I feel like somebody has said something at some point in the study of this phenomena that is either a huge chunk of the truth or pretty damn close to it.
Yeah.
I just don't know if we can ever figure out what that is. It's like we're working with, you know, it's people have said, oh, you know, working in the unexplained is like, you know, pouring out a matte gray puzzle onto the table and you're missing half the pieces. No, I don't think we're missing any of the pieces. I think all the pieces are on the table. I just don't know if we're ever going to be able to figure out a way to fit them all together, you know. So
that's possible.
That's my personal opinion.
I don't necessarily disagree with that. I think go ahead.
I was just going to say, maybe I just tell myself that at night so I don't stay up awake thinking about these things. But
thinking about where the missing puzzle pieces went?
Yeah, basically. We're just, you know.
Well, I think you're right in a sense, but it's not necessarily that we haven't put the pieces together yet. I think it's that we aren't capable of putting the pieces together, if that makes any sense. You know what I mean? It's like
That's
all there, but
absolutely
we don't really
true.
Know exactly how to put it all together just yet.
Yeah, I mean, describe trickle-down economics to an ant, you know?
Exactly,
it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's too, we just haven't really advanced to the point where we can really grapple with all this. You know, I think Jeff Ritzman made a great point on the show a while back. It's like, this may all end up being solved inadvertently by, like, artificial intelligence or something, where they're like, oh, there's a craft outside, you know, and you're like, you can't see it because you don't have the ability, but the computer does. And the next thing you know, that might be what we need to do it all. You know what I'm saying? We're limited by what we have to work with, being humans.
This might have been on your show, or it might have been somewhere else. I'm sorry, I keep on stepping on top of you.
It's all right.
The idea of artificial intelligence coming online and saying, who is that? Who else is that in the room with you? And you going, there's no one else here.
Yeah.
It might have been on your show. It might have been somewhere else. Yeah. Yeah, exactly that.
Yeah. I think that was that was what Jeff said on the show. Yeah. So it's like, I think it is kind of be like that where, we very well may have all the puzzle pieces. There may be something, you know, like this stuff you're dealing with the food. I mean, there may be stuff like that, like you're bringing sort of like new, you know, it's like you kind of come along here and you've got like a little chunk of the puzzle kind of put together in a way. You know what I'm saying? It's like we may
right.
need to start putting together sort of disparate chunks of the puzzle and starting to like look at them as Ripple Junkie says here. We need to rise above the table to see the whole puzzle. It's like maybe the food thing's one thing and then, you know, the sex thing's another. And then it's like you tie in all these different things and then you can kind of start to see maybe some kind of something emerge. But it's It's very flummoxing. I do like how you sort of tie it all together, though, in a sense, where you're looking at all these different phenomena. Because I do think that there's, if we sort of leave the ape Bigfoot out of the equation, because that, by all rights, if it is an ape Bigfoot, it's not a part of the paranormal equation. But when you look at sort of like the fairy lore and the abduction thing, there's got to be some kind of, I feel like there just has to be something there, you know? And it's a mistake that people make, I think, to go in either direction, to jump in either direction. Do you know what I mean? To say, oh, well, the people who are having the abduction experiences, they're having just what people called fairy experiences back in the day. Or the people who were like, oh, the people who were having fairy experiences, they were being abducted. It's like, we can't really say either way. There just seems to be something between the two. They seem to have some kind of connection.
Right. I mean, that's the only thing that I really feel comfortable saying at all, is that anyone who denies a connection is kidding themselves, absolutely kidding themselves. There's a connection there. Whether or not it means it's the same thing or two aspects of the same thing or two different things that share similar motives or some, I don't know, but there is a connection there. Same thing with altered states of consciousness. Anyone who says that there is no connection between these things just isn't looking at the data. Again, does that mean that aliens are hallucinations or fairies are hallucinations or altered states of consciousness tap into something objectively real? I don't know. But there are connections there, and we need to really take notice of that. I've tried to be so careful in writing this book about not letting any of these preconceptions that I have to filter in. I tried to really approach it from as objective a standpoint as I can. So if I sound too opinionated on this, this is just the way that I feel. But I tried to really say, here are some connections. And then the last chapter of the book, as you know, is the only chapter that I've written in first person, where the disclaimer right out the gate is, these are my opinions. This is what I've come to after looking at all this. So
Right.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.